Welcome to episode 466 is here. Do you know someone with endometriosis, estrogen dominance, or just a bad experience through perimenopause? Or maybe that person you know is you. If you're nodding, then listen in. So in this conversation I have with a functional medicine doctor that specializes in heavy metal toxicity and detoxification protocols, we discuss toxin exposure through the entire lifespan. Places you might not even think about, from being born with toxins in the umbilical cord, cesarean sections, being formula fed, farming chemicals that go on even the healthy food at the supermarket, and then living these busy but sedentary lives that are now considered normal. And I want to let you know, this level of health problem, disease, visits to people with ologist at the end of their title, and the super high number of diagnoses or medications that might be in your life, this is not normal, and it's not a sign of amazing health. So if you want to start getting healthier and getting to the root cause, which might be unlikely toxin exposure, then let's dive in.
Welcome to the How to Not Get Sick and Die podcast. You've tuned in because you want to start taking your health seriously so you don't, well, get sick and die. Here we talk all things health, nutrition, and human optimization. Let's jump into it with your host and resident scientist, Maddie Lansdowne.
What's up, my healthy friends? Hope your week is going well and your ears are ready for the good stuff that we're about to share with you. First up, though, this year, it's my mission to support 500 people to achieve real weight loss. And by real, I mean dealing with what's really weighing you down and not just the number on your scale. The link to look into the work that we do with people that have yo-yo dieted for many years, sometimes decades, that link is down in the show notes and the caption below. So if you want to make an inquiry, look into the work we do, scroll down, click the link and reach out and we'll have a chat. Okay, here with me today is Dr. Peter Kozlowski, aka Dr. Koz. He first appeared on episode 299 of this show talking about heavy metal and mold toxicity. So when you're done here, definitely go back and check that out. He's the author of Unfunk Your Gut. He's also a functional medicine doctor with a background as a mainstream pharmaceutical medicine guy right up until he saw the light. Peter, welcome back to the show.
It's an honor to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, you are so welcome. And just before we hit record, we've been bonding over the fact that we've both just had kids in the last little while and just how magical that experience is.
Yeah. Yeah. So I was just sharing that my daughter turned 1 year old on May 4th. May the 4th be with her. And I was just sharing for us, it was a long journey. So my wife had stage 4 endometriosis and had to have her fallopian tubes taken out. So IVF was the only option for us. And so it was a few years of struggle before it worked, but now we have our little miracle baby and it's been the best year of our lives.
Oh, it's such a beautiful thing to hear. We were the opposite in the sense that we didn't need any help and it happened way sooner than we expected. Like, oh, okay, this is where our lives are going now.
Yeah. The best direction it could take.
What a gift, hey?
Absolutely.
So I want to start with a kind of broad question and then we can take it wherever we go. But how often do you hear from patients that come and see you that their regular family practice doctor or their GP has looked at their blood work or their results or their gut tests and they say, everything looks normal?
Every day. I just had a woman today who she's been dealing with hormonal issues for since she had 4 kids in 5 years. One was a miscarriage. So she had 4 pregnancies in 5 years, 3 children. About a year after her last child, really bad hormonal issues started, where heavy periods is what it really started, like really heavy bleeding. And she told me this story where she went from her PCP to her endocrinologist, to her GI doctor, to her dermatologist. And the PCP and endocrine sent her back and forth 3 different times, 3 different OBGYNs. The farthest she got was she had previously been diagnosed with Hashimoto's, where they only measured her antibodies 1 time ever in her life and told her there was no point because there was nothing you could do about it. But eventually, after all, at one point she was in the endocrinologist's office saying, hey, I think this is hormonal. And she was bleeding through her clothes. And the endocrinologist was like, this is definitely your thyroid. You just need more thyroid medicine. And thyroid levels first aren't being checked normally. So they were measuring just a TSH, right? Which in Get the Funk Out, I talk all about measuring free T4, free T3. Also, I love to track people's antibodies because a lot of times they do go down. But the most common condition I treat in a premenopausal woman is estrogen dominance. Mm-hmm. And the classic, I mean, I'd say it's 3 out of every 4 women that come to me have estrogen dominance. And she was explaining to her OBGYN that her symptoms were way worse in the week before her period, which is like classic estrogen dominance. And I can go deeper into what exactly it is hormonally if you want. But the solution that the OBGYN said was just take an SSRI on the last 10 days of your period.
What?
The last 10 days of your cycle. So she wanted her every, like, once a month to start an antidepressant just for those 10 days, which isn't even how antidepressants work if they're going to work. And this, I mean, estrogen dominance is like, you know, the way it presents is the symptoms are way worse in the 2 weeks before the period starts. It's typically associated with heavy periods, with severe anxiety, with insomnia, everything this woman had. She's like, by the book, estrogen dominance. And the classic, even further classic story of her was as soon as she basically got her period, she was put on birth control and basically stayed on birth control until she got married, went through, had kids. And as soon as she was done having kids and done breastfeeding, that's when the hormonal issues started. So, you know, her old teens and 20s, the symptoms were masked through birth control. She was lucky to have natural pregnancies right away back to back. And now at this, she's 40, stuck at this like really nasty estrogen dominant state with, in total, it was like 10 to 12 visits with doctors where back and forth, they're sending her. I don't even know how it was even with a dermatologist. Like, I mean, the issues were hormonal, but they just didn't know what to do with her. So that's just today, but it's every day that I see people that, you know, are just losing their minds because they know they're unwell, they feel unwell, and they're going to their doctor and their doctor's like, everything's fine, everything's normal. It's part of it while she was talking. I mean, I was even like smiling and I have to apologize. I'm like, I just feel so sad that it gets to the point where after like 10 doctors, you need to see me, like the functional medicine doctor, to diagnose like the most basic hormonal imbalance. Yeah. But that story I hear over and over again. So it's a struggle.
Yeah, totally. I'm curious in her particular story, which is possibly common.
Very.
What part do you think that the oral contraceptive pill or any form of contraception that she was on plays in that? Or the 4 pregnancies in 4 years or 5 years? Because my mind instantly goes to, oh my God, calcium depletion and vitamin D depletion, all of those, you know, nutrients that are really required to build a human.
Yeah. It's hard at this, like I'm playing catch up, right? Like I would love to not be the one that's like playing catch up from like what started when she was a teenager. There's a lot of women that are convinced and that, you know, birth control ends up with such a bad hormonal imbalance that they can't get pregnant. I feel like she was lucky in that she got pregnant right away.
Yeah.
But I don't know that, you know, my theory that I write in my book is that it's our toxic environment that's causing women to become so, and it's not just women, men as well with low testosterone, but I believe it's all the toxins, the food, the glyphosate, the heavy metals, the plastics that are damaging our mitochondria, which are then damaging our organs, which make hormones. I don't know whether birth control directly contributed to it or not. I really, with my patients, I don't like to make statements that I can't back up with testing. So I've always tried to remain very objective. Mm-hmm. I can measure the amount of toxins. I can measure your mitochondrial function. I can measure your hormones. As far as like measuring what birth control did to someone, it's, I can't do it. So I don't love to speculate. We know that birth control, it has to be detoxed, right? So if you're having to detox that on top of your daily toxic burden, you know, that's a way it can like play a role. But you're basically, you know, shutting off your natural hormone pathways for a woman. So, you know, whether that's 10 years or 15 years, there a lot of women are lucky that they then are able to get pregnant, right? Because it's like, well, my entire adult life, my entire reproductive life up to this point, it's been synthetically altered. And now I just want to function normally and have kids. It's not most women, I would say nowadays, are not that lucky for things to go as well as they did for her. Now she's left with the residual effects. The something that I'm, since we last spoke, that I've like really added to my practice is genomic testing. So I like to do genetics with all of my patients now. That comes for me, it's very drastic because I spent 12 years telling people not to do genetics. Mostly I make fun of it because of MTHFR, as one of my famous patients once called the motherfucker gene.
Yeah.
that, you know, it's blamed for everything. And so for years, you know, so much when we talk genetics, it was just like, how well do you detox? And you have, if you have MTHFR, then you're going to have heart disease and depression and infertility. And to me, it just didn't make sense that one gene can, you know, out of our 23,000 genes could affect. So, you know, that's the only thing that mattered. So mm-hmm. now the way genetic testing has developed, like we can test genetics for infertility. We can test genetics for estrogen to progesterone. We could test genetics for endometriosis, depression, anxiety. I learned for myself, because I don't remember if I shared the last time, like the way I got into this field was like my own mental health struggles. Well, doing my genetics, I found out it wasn't my fault. It was really my parents' fault that genetically, and I kid with that, but I don't make serotonin. I have two genes that block me from making serotonin. I have two SNPs that on one gene that block me from making serotonin. I have two SNPs on another gene that I don't get serotonin in my brain. So just based on one gene, I had three times the risk of developing anxiety, depression of the average person. I've now treated that through supplements. So the research is so good now that you can make like personalized treatment plans for detox or for anxiety or for diabetes or for depression or obesity based on somebody's genetics. And it's helped me take a lot of the guessing out. So with something like that, even with a woman like, you know, some women, we have estrogen panels, we have endometriosis panels, and we can see genetically certain women should never be put on birth control. We can even look at copper and zinc genetics. Certain women that have had a copper IUD, which were very popular, I think they're put in less, but a lot of women don't handle copper well. And so genetically, if you get that data, you can like strongly advise a woman like, hey, you know, if you were debating whether or not you wanted to get a copper IUD, don't do it. If you're debating if you should go on birth control, don't do it. So many of these things, we've wondered why one person can do this and end up fine, another person not. You know, a lot of it I'm finding is coming down to genetics. It's been such an interesting journey to go on.
Yeah, it's super interesting. I'm actually possibly the only man in a Facebook group of thousands and thousands of people, but it's specifically the copper IUD toxicity group. When I joined that after, you know, having a partner in a former life that basically had all sorts of health issues as a result of contraceptives and was perpetually told it has nothing to do, you know, all your health issues. And she ended up with endometriosis, adenomyosis, and was perpetually told. And it wasn't until she basically went into Chinese medicine and looked at these alternative ways of doing things that she started to not fully heal, but get much better. Once she got off the pill, off that kind of stuff, and the doctors, you know, she'd had 9 surgeries in the time that I knew her. And it was just wild. It's that, you know, it's like, in some ways, it feels like a class of drugs similar to vaccines. It's like contraception does no harm at all. Like, let's pretend there's no damage at all.
Never. Yeah. And there's no question it does harm, right? Talk to almost any woman that's been on it, and most women will say they had a negative experience. The other part of this woman's story from today that I saw is the OBs kept trying to put her back on birth control, but she had such a negative effect from it. Like, she went through so many when she was young to the point where it made her suicidal. She was on it. She finally like quit. She was like, I just saw hers, but so I forgot this part of the story. The OBs, when she went to them first with the heavy periods, they told her she had two options. It was either birth control or an endometrial ablation, right? Which is like a laser surgery to kill your endometrium, right? So, and the crazy thing about that was that she suffered so poorly, so badly from birth control in her pre-pregnancy years, but she was now suffering so bad that between the two options, she's like, well, I'd rather try birth control than do an ablation. So she tried it in 3 weeks. Within 3 weeks, she was suicidal. She has three young kids. And her husband was like, he told her, he's like, you have to stop this. And then she got off of it and she was like, her she had come to the point where she had just decided, I'm just going to live with this until I go into menopause, because I'd rather bleed out every month than get a surgery. That she had, her third OB told her, hey, the ablation might work temporarily, but it's most likely the problems will come back even worse. And, you know, I explained to her, I was like, well, if you don't address the estrogen dominance, yeah, then what you're going to end up with is all this scar tissue and your hormones are still going to be out of control. So that's you just reminded me of maybe the craziest part of this story is she told the doctors, I had a horrible side effects from this. And they were still like, well, we don't have any other options. It's either that or surgery.
Yeah. Wow. I'm curious. I haven't really jumped into endometrial research in a couple of years, really. But is estrogen dominance a feature of it? Is it a cause of it? Is it like why are we seeing so much endometriosis these days?
I think it's two part. And I use my wife as an example. So there's 7 genes right now that we can test for that just having one of them will give you anywhere from 2 to 5 times risk of endometriosis. All right. So my wife has 4 of them. Mm-hmm. So 4 genes independently gave her over double the risk of endometriosis. I've now, in total with my patients, I mean, my sample size is not large because I've only been doing the fertility panel and the women's health panel has only been out. It's not officially out yet. I've been part of a pilot study, but I already have 5 women who had the severe endometriosis genetics, like my wife, where they had 2 to 5 genes, which predisposed them. So obviously, you know, genetics haven't changed. So what is activating those genetics, right? So what I found in researching my patients and my wife is you can find a lot of data about endometriosis being a mitochondrial disease, right? So the thing that I preach more than anything is it is my belief that the reason you can trace most chronic diseases to mitochondrial dysfunction.
Yeah.
Right? What causes mitochondrial dysfunction more than anything? Inflammation, environmental toxin. Environmental toxins are fat soluble, right? So when a fat soluble toxin surrounds a cell membrane, mitochondrial damage, it happens. In one person, I have a woman that has ALS, which is horrible, but she has the second highest levels of lead I've ever seen. There's not that many genes with ALS, but what this lady had was some of the worst mitochondrial genetics I've seen. So to me, it's painting this broader picture of, again, it goes back to our lifestyle, our environment that damages our mitochondria, that in one woman might set off endometriosis, in a man, it's low testosterone or ulcerative colitis or Crohn's, or, you know, in another woman, lupus. So the causation studies aren't like exact. So my wife's story is she was mostly fine. And at 20, she moved into a moldy apartment and started working in an airport. Mm-hmm. She also has very bad detox genetics. So I think poor lifestyle, right? When you're young, severe toxic burden. She also has mitochondrial genetics that are weak or like give her predisposition, which then induced endometriosis, right? And then 7 years of going to doctors, all telling her she was normal. Until finally we went to a fertility doctor, and it was the fertility doctor that finally did a tubal study. And at that point it was stage 4. And she was like, the only option is take your tubes out.
Yeah.
So blessing already just from doing genetics, I had a woman who's been struggling with estrogen dominance. And she goes, I'm convinced I have endometriosis. I've gone to my OB 3 times and they keep saying no. And then she did her genetics, and she's one of the patients I have who has really strong genetics for it. She went back and now she's going to an endometriosis specialist and they found endometriosis, right? Mm. So I don't know why. I mean, there's so many things to talk about with endometriosis.
And yeah.
The biggest one is it's so hard to get doctors to diagnose it. And it's 50% infertility. And, you know, like I told you before we started, like I'm doing a lot of presenting around the country right now about infertility and genetics. But in the United States, the rate of infertility in 1990, can you guess what it was? Or do you want to take a stab at it?
1990, I'm going to say 20%, probably less.
Less than 1%.
Yeah.
0.9%. Right yeah, now, wow. It's 19%.
Yeah. Oh, my God.
So 45 years, you went from less than 1 to 20. Yeah. What's the one thing that's really changed? In America, at least, it's the glyphosate. I personally think that glyphosate is the biggest health crisis we have. I mean, that's been shown to cause infertility in mice and the thing in animals that they let them study. But it just has added to our toxic burden. I will never say one thing is the cause of anything. So I don't want to say it's just glyphosate, but there's really strong correlation studies with that.
Oh, absolutely. But
you throw it in at the same time where they've genetically modified all our soy and corn and sprayed it with those chemicals, with all the antibiotics we're throwing, with the vaccine schedule that has more vaccines that you could count on it, you know, all this stuff, right? So I think it's the most under talked about thing is infertility, like that people can't have babies. And I personally think this was part of the globalist plan is, you know, they're not really pro family, and they poisoned our food supply and poisoned our, I think they knew what they were doing, but I don't know how it's not talked about as the biggest health crisis there is. If it's 1 in 5 couples now, you know, when we were going to our IVF clinic in Chicago, Saturday morning at 7:30 in the morning for our procedures and all of that. I mean, they literally have a revolving door, and the door would just spin all morning long with couple after couple going in there. Getting back to your question of endometriosis, it's an estrogen dominance. Estrogen in most women will make the endometrium grow, right? Mm. So if you have estrogens not balanced with progesterone, yes, I believe that a major connection and a major way to prevent it earlier on is getting women's progesterone up as the best treatment for estrogen dominance to, you know, at the end of the day, I mean, one of my goals for my career going forward is, you know, to hopefully have families not go through what we went through, because the IVF process is, for anybody that's listening that's been through it, it's traumatic. It's extremely traumatic, and it doesn't work for everybody. And so if anybody we can help prevent that, I mean, that's a win for me. And it, you know, I think, like, you know, we have a daughter, you know, when my daughter's in high school, or, you know, they used to teach us sex ed and, like, about, you know, STDs and pregnancy prevention. I think they're going to be teaching my daughter, like, to freeze her eggs. Like, yeah. I don't know how, I mean, at the rate we're going now, right, from 0.9 in 1990 to 20 in 2025, there's no other disease with that kind of, I mean, maybe there, I don't want to say that, but you're not going to find many diseases that are that significant that have that kind of escalation in such a short period of time.
Loving what you're hearing? Make sure you're subscribed here on your favorite podcast app, or there's even more waiting for you over on YouTube. On our channel, you'll get to see our fascinating guests demonstrate their techniques in real time. You'll see my animated explanation of complex health concepts made simple, plus all of those "you had to be there" moments that we mentioned in the show. The Coaching with Maddie episodes will be there too. We're also creating exclusive YouTube shorts, quick, powerful health tips you won't find anywhere else. And let's face it, if we're going to be doom scrolling, which we all do from time to time, you might as well make it worthwhile. Just search How to Not Get Sick and Die podcast on YouTube and hit subscribe to unlock the visual side of becoming a healthy friend of the show. Because sometimes you need to see it to believe it, and also to achieve it. The direct link is in the show notes below. Come and join our YouTube community.
Yeah, well, and I, you know, without slipping too much down the rabbit hole, yeah, I would suspect it's either a plan or either an opportunity that is being realized that in 20 years, 40 years, 50 years, whatever, they will be able to determine who is born.
Yeah.
And yes, into which family and into which genetic expression.
Yeah.
And so, you know, you've got this elitist, pharmaceutically driven world, which we already exist in. I mean, yeah, you know, indirectly, we are able to work in this field to try and help people that are, you know, have these illnesses or want to heal naturally or want to use more of the natural side of things or had bad experiences with the doctor. But every year, it just seems, especially in the West, you know, it just seems to get more and more pharmaceutically driven, more fertility, which puts more power in the hands of the pharmaceutical industry to determine who gets pregnant. And sure, I know there's a lot of the biology that's sort of in that equation, but yeah, it's just this pool of toxic mess from, yeah, what we eat to the medications we take to the air we breathe. Like, it's just so, it feels so inescapable.
Yeah, it is. It's hard. That's, you know, that's one thing I notice when I talk to people who haven't, like, aren't really familiar with, like, the effects of environment. And when you start talking about all the toxins, like, so many people, like, you can see that defeated look where they're just like, well, I'm just screwed and there's not any hope. I mean, I think you have to pick and choose your battles of, you know, you can make yourself crazy trying to be perfect, right? So you, especially, you know, as parents now, you know, how to raise your child in, like, the least toxic environment. And I got to share my favorite, I think, before our daughter was born, story about just becoming a parent. So we got put on, I don't even know how, but we got put on some lists where we would get sent formula to us, right?
Oh, yeah, right.
And Enfamil is a very famous brand in the United States. I don't know if it's global or not, but they sent us this formula in this purple can, I'll never forget it, that said brain healthy, right? It had all these logos on it that said, like, brain healthy, like, this is what you should feed your child. And I was like, I had never honestly looked at a can of formula in my life. I was like, I don't even know what this is made of.
Yeah.
So I turn it over. And what do you think the first ingredient was?
I'm going to guess vegetable oil.
High fructose corn syrup.
Yeah. Well, that was going to be my next guess.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, the ingredient number two, I'm pretty sure, was a plethora of vegetable oils.
Yeah.
So if the only thing more toxic probably to our world than glyphosate is high fructose corn syrup. Like, I'm still like, it leaves me breathless. That's how children are raised. If you walked by in a park and you saw a woman like with a bottle of Coca-Cola feeding her 2-week-old, you'd be like, this is child abuse. But what's the difference than feeding your kid a formula that's top ingredient is high fructose corn syrup? There's none. Right.
I'm
and then
so
they're
on
even
board with
worse.
That.
They're even worse. They're advertising it as brain healthy. Right. Yeah. So there are people that are going to the store. And I one day sat at Whole Foods and pulled every bottle of formula off the shelf, and every one of them had high fructose corn syrup in it. And that's just poison. Yeah. Right.
And, absolutely.
But then, you know, they're taking advantage of the people, right? Because then they're throwing brain healthy on it. So you're going to spend the extra $5 or $10 on that formula than the other poison one, because it says brain healthy when it's made of high fructose corn syrup.
Yeah.
So looking at the whole label, I got to the last ingredient or the last thing before I could justify why they said it said brain healthy. So it said it had carnitine in it, which carnitine has been, it's a great mitochondrial support. I've had a lot of success with it. In autistic children who couldn't speak, it's been really helpful. But, and usually we use like 500 to 600 milligrams twice a day. The formula didn't even have a dosage on it, which means it's like so low that it's irrelevant, right? And so this brain healthy Enfamil was made of high fructose corn syrup with a sprinkle of carnitine. So that, I don't know. I mean, that is, I just get angry at the system. Right. That there's so many parents that are trying to do the right thing, and you trust, I don't know, you don't even have other options, right? Like, we mostly breastfed, but we've been ordering formula from Germany as a supplement because that's what I found to be the healthiest thing I could find. And still, you know, we're importing it from Germany. And then you start looking at all the kids' toys and, you know, all the stuff they play with. It's just like all full of bisphenol S, bisphenol A, and the plasticizers and the phthalates and the food with all the stuff is stored in and the bottles. It's like you're fighting nonstop to do what you can for your kid. And you can't do it all, right? You have to do what you can. You have to do your best without losing
totally.
Your mind.
I'd also say in some ways, like they do with cesarean sections, is similar to these days, I would say, with convenience culture, with formula. So some women that can actually breastfeed are still sold into the idea that it's much more convenient and they don't have to breastfeed in public and it's just easier. Like, you know, it's in our culture. It's just easier. Just do the easy option, you know?
Sure.
And so I don't know if you have this, but I, as part of my intake form for one-on-one clients, if I'm especially if I'm dealing with someone that's got a disease, I always ask the two questions: were you vaginally birthed or cesarean, and were you breastfed or were you formula fed?
Yeah, C-section is proven out to be one of the most disruptive events to the microbiome, right?
Yeah.
And so we always ask that. But the other thing that I think needs to be asked, and we experienced this, I don't know if you did, at 37 weeks, they ask, you know, they, for the most part during our OB visits, I didn't tell them what I did. Like, I just kind of sat in the corner and would listen and just let my wife do the experience. And right before, at 37 weeks, they test the vaginal canal for group B strep, right?
Yeah.
And so they do a vaginal swab for group B strep. And if it's positive, so this is the way the doctor counseled my wife. And he's like, you know, so we're, you know, coming up, we're going to do this vaginal swab for group B strep. It's associated with sepsis at birth. So, but don't worry, if you're positive, we'll just load you up with antibiotics at delivery. And that was it.
Yeah, we had the same experience.
So I'm like, are you going to, should I take out my book? Should we talk about the microbiome? It's 2024 and we're not even going to acknowledge the microbiome of what's going to happen to the baby. I mean, it's no different, right, than the C-section.
Well, the other thing that's a useful bit of information in that situation is that when they do the test for strep, they don't then test again at birth. Yeah. And so, and we asked that question, keep in mind, we had at-home midwives who were very holistically minded and they were giving us both sides. Yeah. And they said, you don't get tested for it again. So you might get loaded. If you end up in a hospital, you get loaded up with antibiotics if you were positive a month ago.
Yes.
And often, and I forget the percentage, but it was a convincing percentage of the time, people that test positive at 36 or 37 have a low enough amount at birth that it's of no concern.
Yeah, so that's, you know, that's C-sections and that's, living in the functional medicine world, you think it's big and then you realize it's nothing. It's tiny compared to, you know, just our, you know, this was like a reputable OB practice that we were seeing that just did not care and made no acknowledgement of the microbiome at all. And it's, one out of every three kids are C-section.
Yeah. It's crazy how high that number's gotten.
Yeah. Yeah. And then if you throw in the women with group B strep, it's, you know, the amount of microbiomes that aren't developing at birth is shocking.
And then they're in these extremely sterile environments as well. And everybody's cleaning everything all the time, alcohol, especially post-COVID. Yeah. Like everybody, you still in the supermarkets here see people walk in the door, get their hand sanitizer. And I'm just like, oh my God, like that poor immune system and that poor microbiome.
Yeah, it's tough. And so, you know, luckily people listening to you and me are, you know, they're more aware, right? And there's more people that are asking questions and learning and doing the right stuff. And, you know, hopefully we can create healthier generations. I mean, maybe we've hit our bottom and we can, you know, teach the coming generations to just think more holistically and just focus more on health than on disease and just the money that's in pharmaceuticals.
I've been asking the question about raising Gabriel and thinking, how do I raise him in a way that he doesn't rebel against natural health because his father does it? How do I get him to walk the same path? I mean, he'll walk his own path, but you know what I mean? Like, I don't want him to be like, oh, my dad, like, I'm not doing what he's doing.
Yeah, it's a balance, right? Like, it's definitely, we could probably have these conversations once a year and figure out how, you know, what to do. You'd still do your best and it might not work, right? So,
totally. I'm curious with this conversation we're having around all of these toxins and the way that people consume them or get in sort of ingest these types of things. There's a bit of a debate, I guess, in the detox space. And when I actually first started out myself, before the podcast existed, the first thing I used to do way back when was every Sunday I would do a Facebook Live and I'd just talk about a topic.
Yeah.
And that was when literally nobody was listening apart from my mum and some random friends. And so the very few medical or doctor friends that would watch occasionally would really roll their eyes whenever I'd start talking about detoxification. Yeah. And they'd be very much like, you've got a liver, you know, you don't need to do anything detox related. So I'm curious with your experience in toxins and detoxification, where is the line from natural detox processes working effectively and those processes being totally out of their depth with the world that we're in? Like, where's that sort of begin and end?
Yeah, it's a beautiful question. I love that question because honestly, I transitioned, right? So I was family practice residency. I did family practice training and I went straight out of residency into functional medicine, right? And that's not many people did what I did. And I had no problem like counseling patients on nutrition, right? Or talking about metabolic syndrome or talking about gut health or even talking about hormones. It probably took me 4 or 5 years of practicing before I was like, I don't have a choice. I have to talk about detox. Mm-hmm. I don't know what happened in medical school or residency, but that was like the scariest subject to touch as a regular doctor. And I almost want to, I don't know, I guess maybe I can ask some of my, a lot of my traditional MD friends don't talk to anymore since 2020, but.
Okay. Understood.
Which is fine, but.
Same.
Yeah. I don't know why I came out of medical training so scared of toxins, right? It was like, I don't know. I was like, for part of it, I was like, I was scared I'm going to get sued if I detox someone. And it's like, why? Like, that didn't even make sense. So I don't know. I feel like there's something that some part of the brainwashing that happens, that something happened where I came out terrified to even touch toxins. I think when talking with anything in medicine, there's a spectrum, right? And I usually fall in the middle of stuff. So one problem I have with detox in general is there's a lot of companies or people that sell these detox products, right? That, you know, you need to take this, and I don't like that, right? I don't think everybody needs a detox product. I don't like that's just for profit, right? That's not the way I operate. And then there's like the traditional medicine doctors that like only acute toxicity. And a classic example we had here was in a town called Flint, Michigan. Something happened with the water supply, and there was a large dose of lead in the water supply. And they had a bunch of little kids hospitalized with lead toxicity, where they had like acute neurologic symptoms. And that was like metal toxicity, which is what the traditional medical world could get behind. To me, the concept that makes the most sense is this concept of total toxic body burden, right? It's the lifetime accumulation of all this stuff that you cannot prove that if you have a level of lead of 10 and of ochratoxin 7 and your glyphosate levels 1.3 and your level of arsenic is 2 and your BPS levels are 6, that then you get autism or then you have diabetes. I have seen patients with like levels you would think would kill them and they don't have symptoms from it yet. I also have seen patients where I'm like, this should be in an insignificant level of toxins and they have like a full-blown chronic disease. Yeah. So I think that's part of the struggle of traditional medicine or even trying to like do the research to prove that this is a problem, right? Because my understanding is, and I'm not like a scientist doing research, I'm in the trenches as a clinician treating people every day. My understanding, like Roundup, which is the main component of this glyphosate, a lot of the research that they did to pass it was just on glyphosate. Mm-hmm. But it's actually all the combination of the chemicals in the Roundup that then creates the true disease. But they don't study that, right?
Yeah.
And they have not studied, you know, if you have this much lead, if you, again, going back to that example, what about all this stuff combined? And I think that's the chemistry experiment that's playing out in our bodies. And we see what's happening, right? With the rate of infertility or the rate of autism or pick any autoimmune disease that, again, no causation. I'm not saying that. But when you look at correlation of all these different chemicals we're finding in people with disease, right? And when I treat people, when you get rid of metals or another toxin, you see the disease go away. That to me is good clinical research and encourages me to do it with more patients. I hope that kind of research becomes large scale. I think we need funding for that kind of research that's run by our government and not by pharma, because pharma is not the way out of this, so they're not going to research it. So that's, I think, our struggle, why the research is lacking. So, and there's not, we can't test all the toxins yet. Like, I think one of our big health crises besides glyphosate and Roundup is microplastics, right? They've done, there's some of the research, it was actually in the New York Times, about like the microplastics in people's brains with dementia. There's not like a blood test yet, or a urine test, or a stool test, or a hair test that confidently, if you do it, to my knowledge, will tell you, yes, you have this level of microplastics, right?
Yeah.
For me, the toxins that I can confidently test right now are some of the ones I've been naming. Like, I can get your level of lead, mercury, arsenic, copper. I can put you on a detox plan for 6 months, and I can show you the levels come down. I could do that with glyphosate. I could do that with mold. I could do that with some of the plastics, some of the pesticides and herbicides. But there's so much out there that we can't objectify, right? So it's hard, right? Some people, you have a feeling they're toxic, and their toxic testing comes back normal, and you're a little bit stuck. I mean, you sometimes can look at other things, or like with me, with the genetic testing now, there's so much we can test in relation to your ability to produce glutathione. There's a gene that shows how well you detox mold, right? So it's been very interesting. My people that are mold toxic, you know, that they have the gene that gives them a hard time detoxifying, or their spouse does not, and one spouse is sick, another one's not. So you can do people's genetics, and like, you know, my wife should have never worked at an airport. She has a very hard time with a lot of the chemicals in the gasoline. Like, had she not done that, I don't know that she would have developed endometriosis, right? So there's certain counseling, like we've already done all the genetics on our daughter. We know what she's set up for. And so hopefully there'll be a strategy. I mean, at the end of the day, you lay out the best strategy, and it could still be in God's plan of what happens. But so long, I don't know if I'm even answering your question fully, but it's a very controversial subject that, like I've talked about, like I like to do things very objectively, and there's certain things with detox you can't do objectively. I think part of the market has been poisoned by the amount of people that are just selling products to make a profit. Mm-hmm. And then you have the traditional training that like is very against it. But I don't know. I mean, at this point, I think it's hard to truly argue that the toxic burden that we're experiencing is not a problem. But the issue you'll run into, it doesn't affect everybody.
Yeah, because we've all got our threshold. It's just some people have a lower one and some people have a higher one. And and it might take a couple more generations in your family for it to show up as well. So yeah, I think it's incredibly fascinating. And I think loosely speaking, especially if we live in a city or we eat out of bag, a box or a can kind of foods, you know, like some kind of health process or toxin release process on any level is going to be beneficial, because a little bit or a lot, you're going to feel better, or you're going to be biologically better off to just get rid of it if you can.
Yeah.
And it's hard in the modern world where convenience foods and toxic lifestyles are much cheaper to access.
Yeah.
And that's part of the conundrum, whether it be, you know, the cost of accessing practitioners like you or I, or, you know, even just eating healthy food or having access to it. It's like, you know, the governments and the subsidies and whatnot for farmers that are set up. It's like the whole system is set up to be expensive if you want to be healthy.
Yes. Yeah. I always love to remind people that the cheapest way to detox: get good sleep, sweat, pee, poop. You're moving your bowels every day. You're drinking lots of water. You're peeing. You're sweating. And you're getting good sleep. You're activating detox, right? Toxins are fat soluble. Detox makes them water soluble. So you're moving that stuff out. If you're peeing, pooping, sweating, sleeping, that stuff's free, right? And I mean, that's part of the reason the problem's gotten so bad is we don't do that, right? The amount of people that are constipated because of that crap diet, the amount of people that are too busy to drink enough water, the inactivity, right? The lack of sweating and movement, the poor sleep, like that stuff builds up. And that's the kind of world we live in, that people, like, you know, it's almost like you're successful if you're living like that, you know, that you're always busy. It's not the healthiest thing.
Totally. Well, I think all the work you're doing is incredible. And I think this has been an awesome conversation. Went in all sorts of places that I didn't expect, which is always nice. Yeah. But for people that are listening in and they want more of you, or they want your book or anything like that, where can we send them?
So my website, doc-koz.com, doc-koz.com. The newest project I'm working, I'm hoping to accomplish. So obviously AI has become a big part of people's lives and chat and GPTs. I am working on a GPT that both practitioners and just regular people can use that is going to be trained to think like a functional medicine doctor like me to, you know, if you're struggling with these symptoms. So you do, like my patient today that, you know, ended up with 10 doctors, you know, just for like a simple diagnosis of estrogen dominance. You know, people are misinterpreting labs. Functional medicine labs are going to be very hard to read. I'm working on training it to interpret labs for people just to help guide even the practitioners. So that's something that's going to be on my website. I hope in the next couple months, I'll update you when that is. But yeah, I'm not personally on social media. I did it for a little while when I wrote my books and it's not for me. So, but my website has my books. And like I said, I'm hoping to get a pretty cool educational tool on there that can help people.
Yeah, it sounds fantastic. And to take us out for the final question, what is one piece of health information you wish more people knew about?
Like your wife said about having a baby, did you know this is so great? Or does everybody know about this, right? I forget the exact quote that your wife said to you, but...
Totally. It's hilarious the way she said it as well. Yeah. I agree. It goes back to this convenience culture. We think, you know, I feel like I was in that world of, you know, like live your own life. You can live all your dreams and do all the cool stuff for the rest of your life and not have to be burdened by a child. And I was like, yeah, that sounds pretty good. Then I had a child and I was like, this is way better than anything ever.
Yeah. Every day is beautiful. Watching her learn and grow and just smile. It's a beautiful process. So I'm going to steal that one from your wife.
Amazing. Well, thanks so much for being here, Peter, and we'll chat soon.
Sounds great. Thank you for having me.
No worries, mate. Hey, thanks for listening to the show. If you enjoyed this episode or learned anything at all, the gift of your 5-star rating would be incredibly helpful. And what's even more powerful is if you write a review. You can do it below each episode on Spotify, every time an episode comes out, and inside Apple Podcast, simply find the main page of this show with all the episodes on it, scroll to the bottom, hit write a review, share your amazing feedback, and then hit send. It helps this show grow tremendously and allows me to successfully invite bigger and more famous guests each time we do the show. Thank you for helping us climb the charts, climb the algorithm, and help more people. Oh, and by the way, I have a short disclaimer as well. I just wanted to quickly remind you that the information provided on this podcast is for general informational purposes only. While we strive to bring you accurate and up-to-date content, it's important to note that a lot of this is mixed with opinions, stories, and ideas not supported by mainstream science or medicine. Any advice or suggestions should not be considered a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always consult a healthcare provider before making any decisions about the health and wellness of you and your family. Remember, too, that what works for one person may not work for another. And just as we promote on the show, each person is responsible for their own health decisions. Thank you for tuning into the How to Not Get Sick and Die podcast. And now, the next episode. Here it is.